Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to have back on the show one of our regular guests. Dr. Robert Bocek is here. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. Every month he's here. It's always on a Thursday. We talk about children's health. So the idea here is, you know, he and I could chat, but really the idea is that if you have questions about your kids or the kids in your life, can be behavior, can be development, can, of course, be about illnesses, sniffles and coughs and whatever else they got going. If you need some advice, you have some questions, you can call us. And I know Dr. Bocek will do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you want to call and talk with him, you can do that. Well, thanks very much.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here. It's better than seeing screaming kids in the office.
Absolutely. Well, although it sounds like here we were chatting before we got going, that relatively speaking, this winter, people have been pretty healthy. And we were chatting about flu or the fact that we really haven't, true influenza, that we really haven't seen it. Not yet. I suppose we still could.
It's been a surprisingly quiet winter. I mean, you know, we're seeing our share of ear infections and colds and you know, a little bit of bronchiolitis and an occasional strep and an occasional flu-like illness. Probably the majority diagnosis right now, the biggest problem right now is a stomach, so-called stomach flu, gastroenteritis, vomiting and diarrhea. But it's been, so far, knock on wood, if there's any in the studios.
I think there is some real wood here somewhere.
We've had a healthy winter.
Yeah. Well, I did indeed talk with some people who said that right around Christmas time, either they were not feeling well or they knew people that were not feeling well and did. Apparently, there was a stomach bug that was really knocking people out for, you know, maybe a couple of days. And you said that you had been seeing people who were having diarrhea. So maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea just to review. Okay, so that happens to you. That happens to one of the kids. What's your home first aid and okay, what do you do?
Home first aid for diarrhea is you ignore it. You carry on with a normal diet. You keep your fluid intake up. And there's good evidence that food somehow has some kind of soothing effect on the mucosa of the intestine, the lining of the intestine. And so we don't recommend dietary restrictions for diarrhea anymore. And I've never seen it. It's hard to dehydrate from diarrhea. As long as you can put something in the top end to keep up with what's coming out the bottom end, you're going to be status quo. You're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Vomiting is the problem, especially in the young kids and the senior. Yeah, all diseases seem to like to hit the young and the very old. It's kind of herd thing. You know, who gets eaten by the lions, the young gnu and the old gnu. And I think it's the same thing with the viral infections in humans. They like the very young, the very old, the weak, if you will. So the main concern we have with vomiting is fluid intake. We need to keep this child from getting dehydrated. We want fluid in. But we want more than fluid in there. We want some salt in there. We want some sodium, some chloride, some potassium, some bicarbonate, and that sort of stuff. So water is a good fluid source, but it doesn't make up for any of the other, it doesn't contain any of the other electrolytes we need. So often in kids, what we recommend is one of the commercial rehydration solutions, and there's several on the market. For the older kids, unfortunately, these don't taste very good. So for the older kids, we'll often recommend one of the sports drinks. And I think the trick is keep it going. Keep them sipping. Keep small amounts going in. They don't have to drink a glass full. Just kind of keep them sipping. And usually you'll be okay that way.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about over-the-counter anti-diarrheals?
I haven't seen anything in any of the journals or pediatric textbooks or anything like that that recommend those at all. I know you see them advertised on TV a lot, but probably not. I think the only one that there may be some validity to is good old ucky-tasting Pepto-Bismol. It may really work. There is some concern about using that in kids because it has salicylate in it. It has bismuth subsalicylate in it. And we don't know if that salicylate is tied up in bismuth or if it's salicylate-like comes free like aspirin, so there may be a risk of Reye syndrome in it. So we don't generally recommend use of Pepto-Bismol in young children. The other products out there, the kaopectates and that sort of stuff, are basically regarded as worthless.
Okay. So just the basic advice, try to make sure that they continue to have their fluids and a normal diet. Just
Vomiting, sure do restrict the diet, but diarrhea, don't restrict the diet. And watch, if they're acting okay, they are okay. I think it's safe to say they're not dehydrated. A dehydrated child really gets very lethargic. They don't care about anything. They vomit and they want something to drink, even though you know darn well they're going to throw it back up at you anyway. And they'll let you know that they're sick, and then they need medical care.
Okay. We have a caller to talk with in Danforth, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a two-part question for Dr. Bocek. My third girl is 7 months old, and she has been breastfed exclusively. And at 6 months, I tried feeding her some rice cereal diluted in breast milk, and she had an intense cramping, and so I stopped. And since then, I've tried 2 times, and she continues to have a lot of cramps and discomfort. And I know that babies need iron at this point in their lives, but I'm hesitant to feed her anymore. And I was wondering how important the iron is and what I should do.
Probably after 4 months of age, they've outgrown the stores of iron that they received in utero from you. Breast milk, breast milk is a good source of iron. It's not a good source of iron. No milk has a tremendous amount of iron in it. The advantage breast milk has over cow's milk and formula in that is that the iron is 100% utilizable. It's very well absorbed. The problem we're getting into here, though, is we're getting into a seven-month-old, and you're right. Cereals are a good source of iron, and yeah, I'm getting a little bit anxious about her iron. And I think iron supplementation would be a good idea. I think the easiest way to assure it is go get a vitamin with iron over the counter, liquid vitamin with iron drops. The other thing you might do is try a different cereal.
Okay.
Try wheat or oat or barley. Okay. I don't understand what's going on exactly because generally it's been assumed that rice is the best tolerated grain of any of the grains.
Yeah, I started with the other kids, and she's had, my other question for you was, you know, since she's been born, she's been crampy. My other girls were too, but starting at about 4 months, she even got worse up until now, and I still have a lot of trouble with gas. She wakes up at night every hour, sometimes more, and it's obvious she's cramping because her knees come up, and then she arches real back, and she does it over and over. So then I nurse her because I'm exhausted, and that comforts her. And
sure.
Back to sleep for an hour or so, and then we start over. And about 3 to 6 times at night, she passes a lot of gas. And, you know, I don't know what to do with her. I feel sorry for her, and I'm tired. And my pediatrician had prescribed her some hyoscyamine drop.
Okay.
But actually, I never saw any change.
Sometimes. It's not impressive. It's worth a try.
Yeah. And I kind of gave up giving them to her because I don't really want to give her medication, especially if it's not doing anything.
Yes.
So those are my troubles, and I didn't know if you had any.
How about your diet?
Well,
is there something going into the breast milk? Because you say that she's always gassy. The rice cereal may make her worse.
Well, I've tried, you know, I eat a lot of vegetables, but I really watch my diet. I don't eat broccoli or beans or anything in the broccoli family like cabbage or things like that, and I generally stay away from anything that would cause her any kind of gas. I don't eat chocolate. I'm not drinking caffeinated coffee.
How about dairy?
I've taken dairy out since the beginning. I really have watched it because I had trouble, like I said, with the other kids. I think it's probably somewhat genetic, but she seems at this age a little bit worse, especially with the gas at night, and I can't figure it out.
Stools are normal. She's not having diarrhea.
No.
She's chubby and robust.
Yeah. Yeah, and she seems happy enough. in the day she has some cramping, but not like at night. It just seems like the gas builds up and up and up and then all night long it's a problem.
She's a tutor.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So I didn't know if you had any suggestions or if I just have to keep going.
You know what you might try? Have you tried simethicone, Mylocon?
Yeah, I tried that before I went to the pediatrician.
Okay, that sometimes works, not very impressively, or often it doesn't, but it's worth a try.
Yeah.
And I guess particularly I bring that up because there's so much gas, and it's a good anti-foaming agent.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'll try it again. I haven't tried it since about 4 months because I started trying the hyoscyamine, but I could give it a try again.
Does she spit up a lot?
No, not at all.
She doesn't waste a bit.
Mm-mm.
Gosh, I'm out of...
I'll just live with it. It's nothing, I just nurse her. I mean, I must nurse her 8 times at night.
Yeah.
And she's 7 months old. I mean, it's kind of crazy, but that's...
Yeah, you're getting tired and yeah.
But it's better than trying to rock her back to sleep because then I don't get any rest. So.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You do what puts her back to sleep the fastest.
Yeah.
And consequently gets you back to sleep the fastest.
Okay.
But I'm just a little perplexed about what this whole thing's all about, what she's trying to tell us.
Yeah. I don't know. I do try to watch my diet because I don't want to go through it every night. But do you think formula is better than breast milk at this age? Or
no.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No, formula's a wannabe. It's a try to be. It's trying to be like breast milk, but it's not. Mm-hmm. And no, I support what you're doing with the breastfeeding. The other thing you might want to ask your pediatrician about is vitamin K.
Huh. Okay.
Because her vitamin K supply may be down, too, because she's not getting supplemented. And there's some, solely breastfed babies. There's been talk about maybe those kids ought to get another dose of vitamin K sometime in their life because they'll run out of vitamin K, which is the vitamin that blood clotting is dependent on.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to talk to your pediatrician about another dose of vitamin K since she's getting nothing but breast milk.
Okay.
And she may be one of those babies that's going to go to... Often, in my experience, breastfed babies who take nothing but the breast till this age, they skip baby food.
Yeah, my other kids kind of did that, too. They didn't want anything to do with the baby food.
Yeah, and then they go to... Yeah, all of a sudden, they're eating hamburgers and French fries.
Yeah. So maybe I'll just hang in there. And she, other than the iron, she doesn't really need any other food at this point other than what she would want to try, right?
Probably not.
Okay.
Probably not. You know, in my career in medicine, I think we started, when I first was in medical school, we started solid foods at 2 weeks of age. And then it went up to, then the cycle swung that the babies didn't eat anything but breast milk till 9 months of age.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think all of us in practice knew that 2 weeks was too early and 9 months was too late.
Yeah.
And 4 months is usually about right, but your children seem to have, they didn't read the rule book that came, the direction book that came with them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate all your help.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Do any children read the rule book?
No. And people have said, Dr. Belichick, why don't you write a book about children? You say, I'd have to write a book about your child and another. I don't think there's one book that will fit children.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Robert Belichick is our guest. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic, and he's here every month on a Thursday. We talk about children's health. Your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also have that toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and calls on us, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Rantoul, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Bye.
Good morning.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question. I have a 3-year-old who does not want to get dressed, ever. And I don't know, we've tried threatening, cajoling, bribing, and I would like a smooth transition from pajamas to street clothes in the morning, and I'm not sure how to get that.
Okay. More details. What time does this child have to go to daycare or anything like that?
To grandma's house a couple of days a week.
Okay.
And, so, sometimes there are appointments that we have to go to together. I mean, we have to be out of the house at a certain time, but...
You know what I think the game I'd end up playing is, I've asked you to get dressed 3 times. I'm bigger than you are. You're getting dressed. kicking and screaming, you're getting dressed.
I hate that part, though.
I know. But I think after a week or two or a finite period of time, this kid's going to say, you know what? I think mom means business here. I better get dressed because I'm going to lose this one.
Yeah. Just be brave and face it, huh?
Steel yourself and do it because, yeah, you've tried being nice. You've tried the cajoling, the bribing, you know. You can have breakfast as soon as you get dressed. And this kid says, nah, I think I'm going to play with my toys an hour longer. Or, you know, this child is winning, is controlling you with over this. And this is one, is sometimes, you know, like we've talked about bowel and bladder control. You can't fight that battle. You can't win that battle. They have ultimate control over that. But this you can control. And if you've tried being nice and you've tried, you know, the rewards and all this sort of stuff, I suppose your other option is, okay, we're going to grandma's in pajamas. You know, we'll put a coat on so you don't get hypothermia and that sort of stuff.
We've done that before, but I guess
you want
to nip this in the bud before it's...
You lost that way. So I think I'd say, okay, I'm going to take your pajamas off and I'm going to put your shirt on. And yeah, and I think you're going to find that the struggle won't last too long before they're helping to get dressed and before they're dressing themselves.
What about a punishment? I mean, what punishment do you think? I'm always confused about what punishment I should give. I mean, taking away a special toy doesn't seem to work. Sometimes timeouts don't seem to work.
No, you're right. You're right. And I think that's why I end up saying, excuse me, I'm bigger than you are. You're getting dressed just because we've got to go to grandma's house or we've got to go to the doctor's office or we've got to go to the grocery store or something. And I just haven't got time to play. When we get back home, I'll read you a story, but now we're getting dressed.
Okay.
Because taking away toys, the problem is, how many toys does your child have?
Unfortunately, too many.
A bunch. And I think that's true for most of us adults, most of us kids. You know, so the TV breaks. I can listen to my CD player. And, you know, so you take my Woody away, I've still got my Tonka trucks or something like that. So that doesn't tend to work. And I think we've talked about timeouts on this show before, on this program before. Gee, when the parent ends up losing because of the timeout, or the timeout, getting them into timeout is taking as much out of the parent as, or more out of the parent than the child, you say, you know, this isn't working either. We got to do something else about this. And I think with a dressing thing, I just say, you know, this is it. We're getting dressed.
Yeah.
You get dressed or I'm coming in to dress you. And it's done.
Well, I'll put up a brave face and
be firm.
Move forward then.
Be firm, but don't beat the child.
I'll try real hard not to.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call.
Say to the last woman who called, bless her heart, and I hope she gets some sleep soon.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. Our telephone number again here is 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have a question for our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. This is our monthly show on children's health. Next up, we have a caller in Champaign. This is line number two.
Oh, good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
I just wanted to suggest a woman might benefit by reading the book by Dr. Dobson, The Strong-Willed Child.
Mm-hmm. And they're all strong-willed, aren't they?
Yes. But I think this really might help her.
Okay,
all right,
thank you.
Very good. Thanks for the call. I'm just curious about going back to something that the question about the first caller that we had. And I think we all know that there are certain foods, and unfortunately they're the foods that we're supposed to be eating, can cause gas.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I wouldn't think that if mom was eating these foods that there would be anything that would then get into the breast milk that would cause the baby to have gas. But does that happen?
Yes, it does.
Huh.
And I think when I first heard about it too, you say, you know, the breast has got to go through the intestine, get filtered there, goes through the liver and gets filtered out there, and some of it goes through the kidney and gets filtered out there. What's getting into the breast milk? But we do know that cow's milk proteins, rather large-sized cow's milk proteins, will go from the intestine and get into the breast milk. And occasionally there are babies who are going to be cow's milk protein intolerant or protein allergic that will have similar problems when they're breastfed until you take mom off of dairy products.
Huh.
So it's really, yeah, it just, through all this filtering system, I guess there's holes in the filter.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I guess I that would surprise me that would be the case. But I suppose that there are concerns about various and sundry sort of things that would be in the mom's diet that could get into the breast milk. So maybe that shouldn't be surprising that it would work like that.
I think it is a little surprising. I mean, with medications and that sort of thing, you say, well, yeah, those are absorbed through the intestine. They're supposed to get in our bloodstream. But milk is supposed to be digested in the intestine. It's supposed to come in the form of short-chain fatty acids and glucose and that sort of stuff, and it's not supposed to come in big chunks of milk.
Yeah. Okay. We're almost at the midpoint here already, and if you have a question, you can call us, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have some other folks here ready to go in Champaign next, line one.
Hi, I'm a very new mom. I've got a 2.5-week-old baby here, and I'm home.
It'll get better.
Okay. Well, we're okay. We're okay. I go back to work in 3 weeks.
Okay.
And, up until probably, I don't know, five or six days ago, I would breastfeed her, and then she'd go right to sleep and wake me up, or I'd wake her up after about 2.5-3 hours and feed her again, then she'd go right back to sleep. Now she seems to be awake a little bit more, and like, so we've got a swing for her, and sometimes I just hold her when she's awake. And I'm wondering, this is going to sound silly, but what else? Can I just put her down in the crib if I need to do something, or should I just continue to hold her as long as she wants me to? Or what do other people do with their babies when they're awake if they need to do something else?
Oh, you know, enjoy her, because you got to go back to work pretty soon anyway. But no, you're perfectly welcome to put her in a swing or just put her down. If she's crying, she's calling for your attention, and I'd pick her up and nurse her or rock her or hold her or whatever. But no, the umbilical cord was cut 2.5 weeks ago.
Okay.
You're not attached that way. Yeah, you're not physically attached anymore, and you're more than welcome to put her down. Put her down in a seat or, you know, in her crib or whatever. Probably put her down where she can, you know, see you and get some human contact that way, and where she'll hear your voice and that sort of thing. And she'll learn to, as time goes on, she'll learn to watch you and fix with her eyes and that sort of thing.
Okay, but at this stage, if she's crying, I definitely should pick her up and comfort her. And
I think so.
She's not hungry, right?
I think so.
Okay.
The other thing you said that bothers me a little bit is, I wake up every 3 hours to feed her. Please don't.
Oh, at this stage, let her tell me?
She will tell you.
Okay.
And if you get a 4 or 5 hour nap at night, thank God for the blessing and enjoy it.
Okay.
Let her set the schedule. Let her, and she will, as time goes on, get to a diurnal schedule like we have, you know, learn to sleep longer at night. And no, you don't have to worry about dehydration. You don't have to worry about your breast milk supply is well established. You don't have to worry about dehydration. You don't have to worry about jaundice. You shouldn't have to worry about jaundice anymore, and let her set the schedule.
Okay. One other quick question. My pediatrician said this, to give her vitamin D supplements. How much should I be giving her a day? I didn't ask that.
Ooh, I don't.
That's fine. I'll call him then. That's
I don't know. We generally don't supplement breast milk with any vitamins anymore.
Okay.
So I'm not exactly sure why he said that. Generally, we don't supplement. Yeah, we feel that breast milk is sufficient in almost everything. Oh, okay. Vitamin D.
Yeah.
Is the sunshine vitamin.
Right. He just said there's a new trend now. He says now they're recommending.
Yeah.
They are
in dark-skinned individuals, so African-Americans, because they don't tend to get sun. Yeah. The sunshine doesn't penetrate their skin, so they may be vitamin D deficient. In some of the Muslims who stay, it's their custom to stay wrapped from head to toe, so no skin is exposed to the sun. They recommend vitamin D supplementation for them in certain cases. But I think for the average, you know, 99% of the people who Yeah, I know it's winter, so we're getting less sunshine, but we're still getting sunshine, and we store vitamin D to a great extent. So I don't think, for the most part, vitamin D, you know, for 99% of the babies or nursing mothers, vitamin D supplementation is necessary.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Urbana for someone else here. Line two. Hello.
Oh, hello. I'm a grandmother, and I just was grinning when I heard that new mom and brand new baby in the home. It was just so sweet. But that isn't why I called. The woman who's breastfeeding and her baby is real gassy at night.
Mm-hmm.
I know that for myself, if I am feeling a lot of gas in my intestine, if I eat rice, sometimes that will be quite useful. And I was just wondering if she feeds the baby a little rice cereal, if she begins to add a little salad and having that be the salad, is there any possibility that that could alleviate some of her pain?
Well, the problem was, and I think this lady's major impetus to the call was, she was making rice cereal with breast milk, and that seemed to make the baby worse.
I didn't hear the beginning of the call. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I agree with you, because we traditionally have always started babies on rice cereal, because that's felt to be the least, like, the grain that's least likely to cause any kind of allergic reactions or any problems that way. So I'm a little bit befuddled by that caller and that baby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well.
Because especially in the third world countries, the underdeveloped countries, what is used to treat diarrhea and vomiting?
Mm-hmm.
Rice water and rice is used as the, yeah, a lot of rice is used to treat these things. So I think you've got a good point, but for this particular lady, not helpful.
As I said, I didn't hear the beginning of the call. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And again, other calls are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. So if an individual's going to have or has a food allergy, is that something that you're going to see right away?
It can be quite variable, unfortunately, and the symptoms can be over a broad spectrum too. No, you probably have to see. They probably have to have some exposure to the food they're allergic to somehow or another. Just like you won't be allergic to penicillin the first time you get it, it'll be the third or fourth or 500th time you get it. So you probably won't see it right away. And milk allergies, food allergies are not very common. Milk allergies are particularly uncommon in young children. And lactose intolerance, the milk sugar intolerance. I mean, we see a lot of kids on a lot of strange formulas. And it's probably get out of my office kind of stuff. Here, try this for, you know, and that'll get you out of my hair for a week or so. And your two-week-old baby will become a six-week-old, happy, smiling baby, and you won't. By 12 weeks, the colic is gone. They're sort of temporizing measures, but they probably don't have much basis in scientific fact.
All right. We have a couple of champagne callers here. First is line one. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Bocek.
Good morning.
Hi. Thank you, first of all, for doing this. I love to listen to you on the radio.
Thank you.
I have a almost four-year-old. He'll be four next month, who I have a question about. He's got a weird habit of being very particular about saying certain things before he'll drink certain things. And when he goes to the bathroom, he has to be wiped three times.
Okay.
A whole bunch of odd things. And I have at first just gone along with it and, you know, don't rock the boat. But now I'm starting, because he's got probably four or five of them that he does regularly. And I'm wondering now what I need to do. Do I need to just stop and let him cry it out or be upset, or should I keep going with it, or what do I need to do?
I think I'd go with it. You know, it bothers. How four is he?
I'm sorry?
How four is he? Is he just turned four?
He hasn't turned four, actually. Next month.
Okay.
So he's almost four.
And I think I'd tell you to just kind of keep an eye on it. He goes to preschool or anything like that?
Two days a week. Two more. morning.
Okay. And he does well there. He separates well there. He plays with the kids well there and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. He's been fine.
I think I'd kind of go with the flow and put up with his idiosyncrasies. I like to say the three-year-old has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder because they do tend to be very busy, and they do tend to be very particular. If my milk is in the green glass, that's great. If you put it in the red glass, it's turned to vinegar or something like that.
That's exactly him. He has special glasses he has to use for special drinks. Certain drinks have to be in certain glasses.
Yeah.
I just, you know, have pretty much, at first just went with it and didn't think that much about it. Now my family's looking at me like I'm nuts because
yeah.
he has these things he has to say before he drinks his chocolate milk. And I have to answer, yes, you may drink that. And
yeah.
You know, so I was worried that maybe if I keep doing it, I'm gonna keep him going and doing, you know, into other patterns.
Yeah, I think I'd go with the flow because usually after four, they come to the realization that, you know what, milk's milk, green glass, red glass, milk's milk.
Yeah.
And my place at the dinner table is not. Yeah, I know I'm going to get fed no matter what place at the dinner table I'm sitting at. If I go potty and then have a story and then get kissed goodnight, that works as well as having a story going potty and then getting kissed goodnight. So, yeah, the 4-year-old will learns that there's more than one way to skin a cat, so to speak, and that, yeah, the end result is the same no matter how you do it. So I think at this age, I don't think I'd panic.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm sympathetic to the caller's concern because people now are aware that there is a psychiatric disorder, obsessive compulsive illness, that can be, in some people, it can be debilitating.
Yeah.
And although I'm sure that all of us have quirks and have particular ways that we want to do things, so obviously there's some kind of line at which it becomes problematic. Do you see obsessive compulsive disorder in children?
Yes.
And you do. And so,
yes.
But perhaps not in a child that young, or might you?
I think in a child that young, the problem we have is they can't express themselves very well, so we don't know what goes on with a lot of them. They think migraine headaches happen in infants and young children, but, you know, they can't tell you about it very well. Obsessive compulsive, the 3 to 4-year-old tends to be obsessive compulsive. It's just part of their nature, I guess. And so to a certain extent, it's developmental. It's normal, so it's not a disorder. I think we don't know what goes on in the young child's mind because they have a limited vocabulary and trying to figure out what they're talking about. Last week in the office, a little girl came in and, you know, I was informed that Holly died. Well, you know, I'm sorry Holly died, and I will express my sympathy, but I need to know who Holly is. You know, how deep do I get into it with this child? Is this Aunt Holly we're talking about,
or is this
the Holly the goldfish where, gee, nice flesh, and there goes Holly? I think with young children, you don't, it's hard to figure out what they're talking about sometimes, and it costs you a little extra time, and, you know, it's fun. I love screaming little brats. I really do. But trying to figure out what a child's telling you is sometimes a challenge.
Yeah, okay. Again, to another caller. This is also Champagne. That's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling in regard to something I read, I think, in the New York Times earlier this week about a meningitis vaccine, and I thought that I'd read that it was going to be included for younger children, but I have a 16-year-old who will be going off to college in about a year and a half,
okay.
And it seems at least a possibility that she may go to the U of I, which has had a history, of course, of problems and even deaths on campus. Due to meningitis, and I'm wondering if this meningitis vaccine is something that you would recommend for a young adult, say, soon to go off to college.
Okay. That's which meningitis vaccine? And I know which one you're talking about. Basically, in infancy, we already give two meningitis vaccines, if you will, the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, which initially brought me to Focus 580 years and years ago, was the number one cause of bacterial meningitis. More recently, for the young children, the heptavalent protein conjugate vaccine against pneumococcal strep pneumonia has come out. And that's one of the major things, infrequent, but it does happen. It causes meningitis. What you're talking about is the vaccine for Neisseria meningitis. And I'm sort of, I don't know exactly what to recommend here. Neisseria meningitis, I think, cause about 400 deaths a year for meningitis, so not very, you know, so it's a sort of a bit player in, your chance of getting hit by a car are much, much greater. Certainly it can be a serious infection. The other problem with Neisseria meningitis is, somewhere around a quarter or a third of the people who get infected with this who get meningitis from this organism are going to die, and it probably doesn't make any difference when they get medical care in the course of the illness. It just becomes an overwhelming infection in them. The vaccine has its problems. There's about, I think, four strains of Neisseria meningitis, and this vaccine only contains two, I believe, and not the most common strain we see in this country. There's 3 years ago, I think, at a meeting, they said, don't get the present vaccine because there's a new one coming out that's going to be far better, and it should be out in a month or two. Well, it's not out yet. So we're left with the vaccine we've got. Well, give the vaccine we've got when the new one comes out. Give the new one, and things will be just hunky-dory. Well, the problem is the titers seem to go down. If you give the new one, the one that's not released yet on top of the old one, for some reason the titers go down, so you end up with less protection from the two vaccines. The Academy of Pediatrics, and that does not recommend college students get meningitis vaccine. The new pediatric red book doesn't. The American College of College Physicians or something like that does recommend it. I think my advice at this time is if you want it, get it. But probably, I think my best advice is don't get it routinely. Hopefully the new vaccine will be out shortly. But the first time you read about a case on campus, be the first one in line to get the old vaccine.
Well, let me ask you another question. Does heredity play any part in this? Because years ago, I was a student at the U of I, and I had gone in for, you know, planter's wart or something like that, and I coughed, and they wanted to stick a swab down my throat, and I said, don't bother, it's a smoker's cough, and they did it anyway, and then they called and said that I was a carrier for Neisseria meningitis, and I'm wondering if that would play any part in whether or not you would recommend, for example, that she have this vaccine.
No. The carrier state, during this time of year, if we grab 100 well people off the street and say, hi, how are you? How you feeling? Do you have any sore throat? Do you have any fever? Do you have any symptoms of any kind? No, you're feeling great. Good. I want to get a throat culture. I want to get a throat swab. Well, about 15% of those people, we're going to find group A beta hemolytic strep. Another 10 or 15%, we're going to find Neisseria meningitis. Are these people going to get sick? No. Are they public health hazards? We don't know. Are they a danger to the community as a whole? We don't know. We're growing Neisseria meningitis or group A beta hemolytic strep. Is this a non-pathogenic? Is this an impotent strain? The culture sure says it's Neisseria meningitis, but maybe it is so weakened somehow or other that it's not going to cause any disease. Or maybe in 0.01% of the population, there is something just a little bit wrong with their immune system, and if they get it, it's gonna go wild. I think we don't have the answer to that one. The outbreak at the U of I, they think now, my understanding is it was related to a campus bar. It's a rather popular bar, tends to get very crowded, tends to be very close contact, and then white cells don't function very well under the influence of alcohol. They get kind of intoxicated, too, so their immunity may have been down, too. So I think, during this time of year, I guess when we talk about Neisseria meningitidis or group A beta hemolytic strep or influenza or anything like that, kind of don't become hermits, please, but hand washing, keep a reasonable space between other people, you know, cover your mouth when you cough, wash your hands and all that sort of stuff, and that will keep the risk of these things down. It won't make us risk-free, but it'll keep the risk down.
Great. Thank you very much for your help.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you. We'll go to a caller here on a cell phone, line 3. Hello?
Yes. I want to go back to the lady who's having trouble with her child not wanting to get dressed in the morning.
Okay.
And I was off for a while, so I don't know if anybody else respond or not, but my question is, why do you want to go in to have such a negative thing by forcing the child? Why not involve the child in deciding beforehand? For a while, several years back, my granddaughter lived with me, and we had quite a struggle trying to get her dressed in the mornings. But if I involved her in saying, okay, you pick out what you want to wear tomorrow, and then if it's, you know, we'll agree on the night before, and then we can get up and we can get it done. And so it was a much more positive than trying to force her, because it just doesn't work when you try to force.
Yeah, thank you for bringing me back to that. Yeah, I'd presume this has been tried. I think you're absolutely right. What? Yeah.
Anyhow, that's just my comment.
Yeah, I think the forced dressing is, I've tried everything I can think of. That's the end point.
Gets everybody off to a bad start.
Yeah, but certainly if you can get them involved, what do you want to wear tomorrow? Presuming they don't change their mind, and that's the other problem at this age. You're quite likely to change their mind by morning, but
well,
yeah, I think, good point. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and thank you, and we will continue. We have another cell phone person here, line number 2. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Bocek.
Yes.
I'm calling with more of a technical question. I work in OB, and I have a lot of women that I take care of women prenatally, and a lot of women, for one reason or another, say that they would prefer for their child not to have vitamin K and the erythromycin ointment right after birth, and I've always thought this was not an issue. But recently, somebody refused the ointment, and they were almost reported to the authorities for one reason or another, and I thought it was totally blown up out of proportion. But my question is it okay, as long as they say it's an informed decision, for parents to refuse vitamin K and erythromycin ointment after delivery?
See, I will bargain over the erythromycin over the eye prophylaxis. The eye prophylaxis, erythromycin, tetracycline, and silver nitrate have been used, and this is to prevent ophthalmia neonatorum caused by Neisseria gonorrhea, by gonorrhea, which can be quite a serious infection of the eye, cause blindness in that. And I will, you know, if I know that prenatal screening for STDs and that is clear, and you know, and I feel in my heart that these people are, you know, monogamous and, yeah, are very unlikely for STDs, I will omit the eye prophylaxis. I will not negotiate over vitamin K. Vitamin K prevents hemorrhagic disease of the newborn, which can occur in somewhere between 10 and 25% of babies. And we think we talked about vitamin K earlier in the breastfed, exclusively breastfed baby. The liver needs vitamin K to make clotting factors. Breast milk is not a particularly good source of it, particularly in the premature baby who may have been thrown out of the uterus a little, evicted from the uterus a little bit earlier. Their stores are down. These kids are at risk for bleeding. Now, if they bleed into their skin or something like that, fine, I make the diagnosis. We give them a shot of vitamin K later on, and within hours, their liver is making vitamin K. The problem is, what if this child's first bleed is into the brain? And they are permanently and significantly brain damaged afterwards. I think where this came from is there was some discussion. It was mainly out of Europe. It's because Europe used a different, a little different type of vitamin K, about vitamin K causing jaundice. We use, I believe it's vitamin K1 in this country. We give it IM. We have never, ever had a problem with it. There's some talk about oral vitamin K. I suppose we could negotiate that with these parents who refuse a vitamin K injection, but I will not. I think there's too great a risk. I think there's no, even Europe says we need vitamin K. I think their debate now is whether it's what mode it's given by, but I won't negotiate with vitamin K.
I don't disagree. I mean, I know why we give it, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. My question, though, is...
Is this child abuse?
Well, is it, yeah.
Is it reportable?
Do they have to have it, or can they sign an informed consent saying, no, we don't want it? Even though you've explained...
I think they can sign an informed consent. I think... In my years, I've never had a patient, when I tell them I'm willing to negotiate on the eye prophylaxis, but I'm not willing to negotiate on the vitamin K, and why, I've never had a parent refuse the vitamin K.
Okay.
So I think what I'd do is, I'd let them sign a release. I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, vitamin K prophylaxis is not a law or anything like that. But I think I'd spend longer talking with them if you can about the importance of it.
Okay.
Because I think it's vitally important.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And back here to another caller here locally in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a little guy who's going to be 6 in February. He's in kindergarten. And last summer, he took to starting to chew on the collar of his T-shirts, and he would get them wet. And he pretty much stopped that because I was very annoyed with him.
Not only wet, they got disgusting looking.
Yeah, but then this fall, he has started wanting to wear warm, comfy sweatshirts, and he tries to bury his chin in the neckline. And I have started saying, get your chin out of your shirt. But it's becoming a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, I noticed the past couple of weeks, has been smiling, a great big smile, so that he pulls his upper lip across his teeth, and it's almost like he's playing with his lip. Now, I haven't said anything to him about that. Since he was about 2 years old, I have noticed that when he would be sitting reading a book, he would tend to shrug one shoulder,
mm-hmm.
and I never said anything about that, but this chin in the shirt really bugs me. What's the proper handling of habits like this?
You know, I think I would try and change an obnoxious habit into a more socially appropriate habit.
Okay.
Maybe convince him that he's got chapped lips.
Okay.
And maybe he does indeed feel some lip discomfort, and maybe just a tube of some lip balm would be quite suitable. He could carry that in his pocket and use that.
Now, should I be saying, Stephen, look at yourself in the mirror. Look at what you're doing and say, that looks weird. The kids are going to say something about that. You shouldn't do that kind of thing. How?
You know, I think your ultimate out is the kids. Stephen, okay. Why do you do that? That looks kind of dumb.
Okay.
I'll bet you, I think this is one where, and again, Stephen is perfectly well-adjusted in society other than these little quirks.
Yes.
Okay, then I think I'd probably, I'd try some lip balm, see if we can switch him over to that, and mostly I think someday one of his friends is going to say, Stephen, why do you do that?
Yeah. Okay, I wasn't sure if it was negative to bring it to his attention, if that would enforce it.
It might, and it might enforce it. I don't think so. I think he's just going to kind of ignore it.
Right. Okay.
And you're not going to, yeah, since you're his mother, you're going to love me whether I put my chin in my shirt or whatever, and you're going to get the stains out of the collars and that sort of stuff. But when Johnny at school says, Stephen, that looks kind of dumb. Why are you doing that? I'm going to quit.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, we appreciate all the calls this morning. I think about this point we're going to wrap up with the promise that next month, we'll do it all over again. Dr. Bocek,
yes,
will come back. Robert Bocek is pediatrician at Christie Clinic in Champaign. He's here every month on the show. It's always Thursday. We talk about children's health. Thanks very much.
Thank you.